last Sabbath was July the 4th. July the 4th is celebrated as the birthday of our nation. And it's, I guess we would say, an anniversary celebration. In 1776, I'm not sure the signing was actually on July the 4th, but it was near to July the 4th. The Declaration of Independence was signed by a group of men in Independence Hall in Philadelphia. I've been to Philadelphia in July, and it's a pretty uncomfortable place. And they didn't turn the air conditioning on. And so they were there meeting in a hall to determine whether or not, and they fought over this matter for some long period of time. They argued back and forth between the men who were delegates to the Continental Congress as to whether or not they would do this. It was a radical departure, not only for the government of the United States, but worldwide, especially in the European areas. They had an entirely different form of government than what the Declaration of Independence of the United States was intending to provide for us. A whole different notion about that philosophy of government. It had been a year, more than a year, since the Battle of Lexington and Concord, where the shooting at each other began in Connecticut, and the British Army and the American, hardly could be called an army, people in America who were rebelling with the Continental Congress, some of whom were arguing for writing a Declaration of Independence, others of whom were deeply opposed to it because they still felt they were loyal British subjects. It was a radical departure from entire governmental structures worldwide at that time. It was somewhat, maybe, if you wanted to make a comparison to something that we see today, it might be that we would look at communism versus capitalism as a completely different system of government. Well, they were operating up until that time under a system that was known as the divine right of kings. That is to say, the king was ordained, as we read in Romans 13, the king was ordained, and he had ultimate power to accomplish all kinds of things. He had a divine right from God. And so we'll see in a few minutes here how the Continental Congress authored, we're just going to talk about the preamble. Well, we'll talk a little bit about the concluding lines too. How the Continental Congress authored a completely different concept of government than was in existence on the face of the earth at that time. So it's a radical departure, somewhat akin to the way communism and capitalism would be regarded as diametrically opposed to each other at this time. For the previous 2,600 years, roughly, I don't know if I'm exactly right on that, but I'm pretty close. Previous 2,600 years, the dominant form of government was the divine right of kings. If you've seen the movie Braveheart, you see what is being fought out there among the Scottish people. And you will see that in that movie, William Wallace is very loyal to Robert the Bruce. And he keeps making this statement. It says, Robert the Bruce was really a snake in the grass to William Wallace. But William Wallace remains faithful to him, saying it's his right. He is the rightful heir to the throne. Where did he get that notion? Where did he get that notion? Why was Robert the Bruce the rightful heir, as opposed to three or four people there in Scotland who were vying to become the king of that nation? But Robert the Bruce, according to William Wallace's belief, was the rightful heir to the throne. Hazel and I had the opportunity 25 years ago now. Hard to believe, but I think it was on our 25th anniversary. Bryant and Lisa and Lori, I guess, all contributed to get us a trip to visit London and then to Edinburgh, Scotland. In Edinburgh is the castle where a lot of the things from the time era are still held there. And so we got to see those things, and very awesome. And if you ever had the opportunity, I would recommend that you take it. Here's the basis for the divine right of kings. It's a covenant that God made with David. And it's really an unconditional covenant. God gave this to David and didn't ask for anything from David other than what David had already given to God in God's will. It was kind of a reward almost for David as a result of how he had been obedient to God and committed to God. 2 Samuel. Where we find maybe a concise place where this is written. God is having Nathan the prophet appear to David, and Nathan tells David, "Your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever." And then verse 17 says, "According to all these words and according to all this vision, so did Nathan speak to David." So it is from that occasion that God established David's throne forever. And from that, this is what is inferred, although they never come to terms with it in the movie Braveheart. It nevertheless is inferred that this is the reason that William Wallace supported Robert the Bruce, because Robert the Bruce was a descendant of David. And it was Wallace's opinion, apparently, that he felt that the throne should go to Robert the Bruce as opposed to the others. Well, in Constitution Hall, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, essentially, what happened when the Declaration of Independence was agreed to and signed, the delegates just told the king, the go fly a kite, essentially. I mean, put it in our slang language, that we would say, well, there is no divine right of kings. All men, we'll say in a minute, it says, all men are created equal. The king has no more claim to this because he's a descendant of David than anybody else. All men are created equal, they're going to say. So it was in making that statement, writing this declaration, and in particular, we're going to look at, we're not going to look at the whole, try and look at the whole declaration, but we're going to look at the preamble, although they're considered to be two different preambles. I think the main significant preamble we're going to look at and compare it to what we believe and understand in the churches of God. So it was, the message was, divine right of kings is not anything that we're going to adhere to. And so it was a stick in the eye of the king. And it was a rebellion against the systems of government that were predominant, at least all through Europe, at that time. Now, this is a radical departure begun. It wasn't concluded, and it hasn't yet been entirely concluded today. We still have monarchs and so forth who live by the divine right of kings, and we still do, as God promised, have a descendant of David sitting on the throne in London, not exercising governmental authority, but having the position. So this departure was from divine right of kings to rulership based on every man having his own ability granted to him by God. Representatives of the 13 colonies, there were 13 colonies. I counted in the room today, counted it several times, came up with 12 a couple of times, but the correct number of people who are here at this service today are 13. That's kind of interesting in relationship to this message. Representatives of the 13 colonies. And this was interesting at the time. They had to have unanimous agreement among the colonies. They did not have to have unanimous agreement among the individuals. You see, there were a number of people who were delegates to that convention who didn't agree to this. But a majority of every one of the colonies did agree to it. And if only one colony had failed to agree to it, they wouldn't have passed the Declaration of Independence. So I think if you would like to get a pretty good idea of this and get a pretty good education of what happened and how it happened, there's a musical stage play. Maybe this would be good for the Kalias. If they like music and perform music for us. And this is a very interesting, not only political, but musical stage play. And it gives you information about the personalities of a number of the men who participated in that Congress to determine whether or not the Declaration of Independence would be signed. So I'd recommend, if you have some interest in that, that you might get it and view it. I even had the highest recommendation, Mr. Thomas Shavak, who told me he didn't like musical plays, sat and looked at it, and after it was over, he said, "I really did like that." Because it presented the politics and the personalities of the people who were involved. There were 56 men who put their name to this document, the Declaration of Independence. Representing the 13 colonies and a majority, at least, of every one of the colonies. They made the following, these 56 men made the following pledge to each other. And I would suggest to you, we've made a similar pledge to each other. I said we're mostly going to be talking about the preamble of the Constitution, of the Declaration. And this is a place where we are not discussing something from the preamble. This is in the last sentence of the Declaration of Independence. According to redstate.com, the final declaration of the final sentence of the Declaration of Independence is a promise among the signers. There are 13 of us here. We've all signed on to something, haven't we? Or we're in the process of signing on, if we haven't yet. That is a covenant with God. And the covenant is not only with God, but also with each other. The final sentence, Declaration of Independence, is a promise among the signers to mutually, that means between each other, pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. And it says here in redstate.com, many of them and their fellow patriots did in fact sacrifice their lives and fortunes in service of their country. I guess it just sort of presents a question to me, especially since we're in the midst of the kind of turmoil that we're having in this country, and I can see the possibility it could grow into a third civil war. First civil war was the Revolutionary War against the King of England and the English. Second civil war was in 1860. Between the nations of the North and the South. And here we are in a conflagration, what appears to be a conflagration that is growing and growing. And here we see they pledge their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. And the question presents itself to me, can we, as members of God's church, do anything less? Haven't we also pledged to each other, mutually pledged to each other, our lives, our fortune, and our sacred honor? Are we willing to lose all of those things? I think we, if we've been baptized, we made that covenant with God that we would do that. In Luke 14, baptism counselings talk about or inculcate this into the counseling. You have to count the cost And before our baptism, before we can make that covenant, we have to know what the cost is, and we have committed ourselves to make that commitment. So what I want to do in this sermon is to use the preamble of the U.S. Declaration of Independence as a pattern to compare in this sermon some similar but substantially different facts or items in the Declaration of Independence which I propose to put forth for the Sabbath keeping churches of God. So let's begin by quoting the preamble to the Constitution. And a preamble is a part of a document, for our professional writer in the back there. Preamble is where, in part, the purpose of a document is set forth at the beginning of that at the beginning of that document. From Civics, CLEIVICS.com is the preamble to the U.S. Declaration of Independence. This is not a part of the Constitution. This is from the Declaration of Independence. Preamble to the U.S. Declaration of Independence reads, "We hold these truths." Now that in itself, we could spend a sermon talking about holding and truths. But we hold these truths. And that the holding there is like and capturing it and having it pinned in iron. Really a strong hold. We hold these truths. And the notion that there was any such thing as real truth is something we'll look at a minute later. But those founders, 56 men, and they understood what they were saying a lot better than we may understand what they said. These truths, and the world has doubted that there is any such thing as truth. I had a college professor when Brian and I were taking courses together in college who said there is no such thing as absolute truth. Everything is relative. So he had been told some of the things I'm sure. He said, "I know you believe that." And he said, this is in front of the whole class now. He says, "I know you believe that." How did he know that I believe that? Well, I presume there was a girl in the class, a woman in the class, not she was beyond the teenage years, a woman in the class who attended services, and apparently she was taking back to him what I said as part of the opinions of my sermons. And she apparently told him that I believed that there was absolute truth. And there wasn't anything about that wasn't true. She wasn't telling him something I didn't believe. But he said, "I know you believe that." And so we had a contest there in front of the audience as to, in front of the class, as to whether or not there was any such thing as absolute truth. Won't go into that, but the world doesn't believe in absolute truth. The preamble states, "We hold these truths." Now, Theo writes about the Sabbath day, and she obviously believes it is a truth. She writes that it is the way. That's the title of the article that she has written, "The Way." And we'll see some of that as we go through here too. We hold these truths to be obvious. No, self-evident. Pretty much the same thing as obvious. We hold these truths. We say there is truth, and this is not just physical truth, which is much easier to prove, but this is spiritual truth. We hold these truths, spiritual things, to be self-evident. What do we mean by self-evident? We'll get to that. All men are created equal. Now, just the idea that men are created, men were the creation of God, it wasn't maybe so contested at the time as it is today. We believe that man, at least we, not being you and I, but we as a society as a whole, not only here, but throughout probably the majority of mankind, believe that human beings evolved. We'll talk about that a little bit too, before we get through here. All men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. That means rights that from which they cannot be separated. Unalienable. They're endowed, it says, with certain unalienable rights. Are all, I guess I just posit this thought as we are going through here, the preamble to the Declaration. Are all men created equal? Well, if you put it in the way that they were putting it at that time, that means the king ain't no better than the rest of us. So, again, they were doing something that was going to be, they knew would be offensive to the king and to the majority of the governments throughout the world, in that they believed in the divine right of kings because the king was a little bit better than anybody else. And here they were saying, all men are created equal. Now we could say, are all men created equal in terms of abilities? And we'd have to reject that idea pretty quickly, wouldn't we? Although there's a large segment of people who believe that all men are created equal in terms of abilities. What about in terms of accomplishment? Accomplishment is not even necessarily a matter of being created in a certain way, is it? It's a matter of commitment and devoting yourself to those things. What about aptitudes? No, they're not. Who was the author of the Declaration of Independence? Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson. And he was a slave owner. Today, there are many people in the country who have been convinced that there should be no recognition of anything that any of these slave owners did, and they're going around the country tearing down any symbols of their accomplishment. Thomas Jefferson was the man who wrote the Declaration of Independence. Now, it was signed by 56 men, and they debated probably every word in this preamble before they finally passed the whole Declaration together. And adopted it and put their names to it. Who were the main advocates of the Declaration of Independence, including Thomas Jefferson? There were, John Adams was one of the main, you see him in the movie, he quite emphatically portrayed in that movie. Benjamin Franklin was a second one. Thomas Jefferson was the third. They were the three major advocates for the passage of the Declaration of Independence. Another guy who was a big advocate was also, although now of those three, I don't know about John Adams. He might have, I think he did have some slaves in his home in Massachusetts. Benjamin Franklin had no slaves, and he was very dogmatically against slavery. So was John Adams. Thomas Jefferson fought against slavery, even though he was a slave owner. He tried to, in the Declaration of Independence, as it was being debated, he and Adams and Franklin tried to do away with slavery at that point. A man from South Carolina by the name of Rutledge, who was the primary advocate for retaining slavery. So there was a lot of personal information there. Ultimately, the passing of this Declaration of Independence depended on one man. That one man is a hero, although not well remembered or recognized for it, is a hero of the founding of the American nation. His name is Cesar Rodney. Cesar Rodney was from the state of Delaware. During the days leading up to the signing of the Declaration, late June, Cesar Rodney became ill, and he was clearly on his deathbed. So he left and went back to Delaware. Now, he was the one vote they needed in order to get the state of Delaware to vote in favor of the Declaration of Independence. So they sent to Delaware in a wagon in July, laid him down in that wagon, and brought him back to Philadelphia so he could cast his vote. He was a hero. He literally, at that point, was the first person, probably, to lay down his life in doing that. That's the environment from which the Declaration of Independence sprung. Fifty-six men in all 13 colonies put their names to the document with this preamble. Preamble again, we hold these truths to be self-evident, created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. And here's the litany they mentioned of those unalienable rights: life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. And I'll suggest to you that we also are signed on to producing life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, although in a very different way than those men did when they signed that document. We hold these truths to be self-evident. What about truth? And what about being self-evident? That's kind of a slippery slope, because truth is often, is not very often self-evident. It's often argued about between people, but it's not necessarily all that self-evident, although we have truth that is self-evident, don't we? Our definition of truth comes from the face of the eagle. What do I mean by the face of the eagle? Well, I mean the Gospel of John. John being the fourth beast, it calls them, by the throne of God, three other Gospels. And the fourth one being, which we haven't discussed yet, the face of the eagle. But the eagle has a sharper vision, goes higher, and sees farther. And I found out this week as I was reading a little bit about the eagle, that the eagle has such eyesight. We talk about an eagle eye. An eagle can have and process two visions of separate things at the same time. Now, that seems really unusual, difficult to do, doesn't it? You only have one brain, but you're processing two visions at the same time. And they can see from hundreds or even 1,000 feet away and see a couple of miles down the river and see fish. It's amazing what the eagle eye has. And if this gospel be a fulfillment of the eagle, then when you look at it, you should be able to see farther and crystallize the things that you see and gain understanding from the eagle that you don't get necessarily from any place else in the Bible. So here's one example, John chapter 17 and verse 17. Here's the eagle rising higher to show us something that we didn't see in any of the other Gospels. It says, about you, sanctify them. What does that mean? Set them apart for a holy purpose through your truth. God has truth. There is truth. Absolute truth, as it says. And that truth is so absolute that it can set you apart for a holy purpose. Make you entirely different than you otherwise would be. Sanctify. Sanctify them through your truth. What is truth? Well, that was a question asked by Pilate whenever he was considering whether or not Christ should be put to death. He said, what is truth? Here's the answer in John chapter 17 and verse 17. And this is only from the night before Christ answered this to Pilate in the judgment hall. Thy word is truth. Of course, we have to be able to rightly divide the word of truth in order to come out of it with what God means in saying that. That's the definition of truth. That's our definition of truth. Your word is truth. You can establish truth in some ways, and we'll look at creation, and we'll be able to physically establish truth from the example of creation. But here, It also tells us in God's word that His word is truth. So if you're in conformity with what the Bible says, you will have truth. Your word is truth. Backing up a couple of chapters here, again, the eagle rises up, sees a little bit further, and maybe even creates more than one vision at a time. He says, Jesus said unto him, I am the way. That's the title of his article, The Way. I am the way. And it's a series, so you can read a series in this way. I am the way, that's the first thing. I am also the truth, that's the second thing. And I am the life. No man comes unto the Father but by me. That's something that the eagle gives us that nobody else in the Gospels really gives us. It's unique. It helps to establish the fact that the book of John is the face of the eagle. We hold to this definition of spiritual truth. In fairness, we have to say that, in fairness to the writers of the Declaration of Independence, we have to say that the Declaration doesn't say that all truth is self-evident. There's a lot of truth that takes a lot of work to try and establish, and maybe some we can't even establish. Creator. We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created. A created thing must have a creator. So it is saying, it is a statement about the belief in God, which was not contested very much in 1776. Men have lost the ability to think on their own, which they seem to have a much better ability of in 1776. In concurrence with the preamble of the Constitution and the concept that there was a creator, that was a highly contested fact. Today, many people do not believe that there is a creator God. We're involved in the theory of evolution. But Psalms 14:1 tells us a self-evident truth, but the Bible confirms it as well. The fool, Psalms 14:1, that's very strong language, isn't it? We're told in Matthew 5, Sermon on the Mount, that we don't call any man a fool. But here the Bible calls those who don't believe in the existence of God a fool. I wouldn't go and say that myself. I'll read it, and I'll tell you what the Bible has to say, but it's not a leap that I would make myself. A Psalm of David. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. It tells us in the book of James that even the demons know there is a God. They tremble at that fact. But here's a piece of physical evidence that's kind of revised many of the really perceptive, has revised the mind of many of the really perceptive scientists on the face of the world. The electron microscope has such magnification power as to be able to take a single skin cell. How many skin cells do you have? Many of them. It can take one skin cell and magnify it so that the magnification makes the cell appear as like 12 kilometers in diameter. It magnifies it enough that if it was a real physical item, it could be set over the top of Buffalo. One cell. And you got millions and millions of them. Probably billions and maybe trillions of them in your body. That's just skin cells. But what about all the other cells? And something caused this to happen. Did it just evolve? Let's look at some of the information about that one skin cell, if we were able to produce one in physical terms and put it over the city of Buffalo. The skin cell, they tell us, and I have a video on this, maybe sometime we could view it in a Bible study. But it says in there that the single skin cell has 100,000 openings into it through which it receives nourishment, discharges waste, and prevents unwanted things from getting in. They have each one of these openings, 100,000 openings, have an intelligence on them that they can tell what's coming in the bloodstream. If it's something that they want, this security device will open the door and let food, nutrition, or whatever that is needed by the cell in. But then if something like a virus is coming, it'll slam shut and prevent the virus. Obviously there are some failures of the security system. It'll prevent those unwanted things from coming into the skin cell. That's just one kind of cell that you have in your body. So imagine how this could have evolved. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And we, of course, we only, probably since 1980 or sometime along about then, really had the ability to magnify things to see all of this going on in the way that we can. God is the creator. Anybody who says there is no God is just wrong. And the Bible says that the fool has said in his heart there is no God. We sit on the deck at our house. And in years gone by, not this year, but in years gone by, a robin would build a nest between one of the lights that stick out off of the sidewall and the sidewall of the brick wall of the house. And the robin goes and comes, lays her eggs, hatches her eggs, goes and brings food to the baby robin until the day that robin flies. How long does it take the robin to learn to fly? They just get up on the side of the nest and they fly. They didn't have to learn anything. Somehow, somebody put that intelligence in the robin's brain. It isn't a learned response at all. They just know how to do it. Or you can look at the same when an animal is born, like a deer. How long does a deer have to learn to walk? He has to know how to do it pretty quickly, doesn't he? And also how to run, because there's all kind of predators that might be after that fawn. See, it just is amazing how those things happen. By contrast, I remember when our kids were learning to walk, it takes a human a year, pretty much, on average, to learn how to walk after they're born. And we remember when Lisa was not willing to be patient. She never has been a very patient person, but when she was 6 months old, she figured out how to climb out of her crib, and we heard her hit the floor. She was trying to get out of there and live like the rest of the people and learn and start her walking. And it didn't turn out all that well for her. But that's kind of, you know, the difference, the contrast between what God put in the different creatures in his creation. He is the creator God, and he had the ability to create some of them to stand on the nest and fly. They had to have feathers first. They sat in the nest while the mother brought food, and they grew feathers. They got up and they flew. We saw a flock of geese as we came into Hamburg, and those geese along in one particular yard, Hazel said, "Oh, that's going to be a messy yard." But there no doubt was a number of those were the offspring of one of the other geese. And you see everything going on. Here's biblical confirmation. In 6 days, Exodus 20 and verse 11, the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Biblical confirmation, isn't it, that God is the Creator? It is a Sabbath command. Every Sabbath when we come here, and we worship God, we are memorializing his creation. The Sabbath isn't just a spiritual observance. It is also, among other things, a memorial to God for his creation every time we come together, every time we keep it. Endowment. That was the next thing in the declaration. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator. What is an endowment? An example of an endowment we think probably of more. We use the word more of it in this regard than any other way. An endowment is a gift that an individual may give to a university so that the university can give out scholarships from year to year. And the endowment might be funded by bonds, and a certain amount of interest collected off of those bonds every year. And that interest money might go to somebody selected by the university for a free education, provided they live up to the obligations that are necessary to do that. That is the endowment. And it is saying that we are endowed. The Declaration says we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That litany. Life. Are we endowed with life? I'm getting a little too close to the time when I'm going to prove that we're not, but we're not guaranteed life, are we? We're not endowed with life. We're subject to a termination of our life at any time. And if we look at the fact that God says, in the day that you take from the fruit of the tree of evil, you will die. And so, we don't have that as an endowed right from God, not our Creator God. He gives us, instead of an endowment, a guaranteed outcome, He gives us opportunity to become the recipients of life. But it's based on conditional things that we need to do. Romans 6:23 tells us the wages of sin is death. The gift of God is eternal life. We have a gift coming through Jesus Christ our Lord. What about liberty? It says the Spirit of the Lord, Luke 4, verse 18, which is a requote of a scripture from Isaiah 61, and verse 1. The Spirit of the Lord, Christ, had just come back from being tested by Satan the devil. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because He has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, and the recovering of sight to the blind. And I would say He has given you, as you have become a servant of Jesus Christ, He has given you all those same responsibilities, and to set at liberty, you have the opportunity to participate in this. To set at liberty them that are bruised. Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. You know where we find the word happiness? Again, the eagle flying higher, seeing more than maybe we would see otherwise. In John chapter 13 and verse 17, it says, if you know these things, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If we're pursuing happiness, it said, if you know these things, where do you hear that every year? On the Passover evening, when you wash another person's feet, happy are you if you do that. Are we endowed with happiness? Again, we have to do something in order to make that a reality in our lives. If you know these things, happy are you if you do them. Declaration of Independence was the beginning of what is now an entirely new and different world, but still being contested by others. for the next 244 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence. That's how many years it's been. 244 years since they sat in that sweat box in Philadelphia, argued about it for months, and finally signed it under penalty of death. That's 244 years ago. The war was fought, and it was one of the big factors in determining whether the governments of this world would operate under the philosophy of the divine right of kings or under a radically different form of government, where individuals have rights superseding the rights of the king. That war is still ongoing. Closing sentence of the Declaration. Not in the preamble, it's a closing sentence. We solemnly publish and mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Can we, as members of the Church of God, make a similar pledge? Here's what Thomas Paine, by the way, Althea Thomas Paine wrote at one point, that the pen is mightier than the sword. So if you want to write and you learn how to write and you can do that, then the things that you do will be mightier with a pen than can be done with a sword. That's what he said. We mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Here's what Thomas Paine said, and it seems sort of relevant or parallel in its wisdom to the situation that we're under right now. We are, as a nation, under somewhat of a crisis. Thomas Paine, who was known as the firebrand of the American Revolution, wrote this: "The summer soldier, as a sunshine patriot, will in this crisis shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands by it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph." Here's a preamble that I have authored, kind of imperfectly, obviously. We hold these truths to be self-evident. God is the Creator and has endowed all men with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, liberty through service of other people, liberating not ourselves, but liberating them from the difficulties of this world, and the pursuit of happiness through membership in the family of God the Father. Through our covenant, we have mutually pledged to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.